So, friends, I'm going to respond to some questions. How important is it to maintain continuity of the meditation object? Well, the objects of meditation can be varied, could be breathing, could be elements, such as the elements of the body. It could be qualities of heart, metta, karuna. Could be qualities that cause dispassion, such as the unattractive aspects of the body, death. You know, these are objects that have their own, carry their own meanings, if you like. And those can help to establish presence. That is, if the mind is constantly really racing around, then we want something that's going to anchor it. So we choose a meditation object that will stabilize, like body, walking, standing, sitting, reclining, just come to that mass of sensations that are quite palpable. Yeah, you can anchor it on that. If the mind is obsessed with all kinds of details, then it's good to go to the space or the silence. Someone mentions the sound of silence as a meditation object. Now, the sound of silence, which you've probably heard of, I have heard Lumpur Samedo would make that his main meditation object, particularly when he was very occupied, very busy with often quite controversial or complex or impactful experiences, supervising a sangha, committees, monasteries, yada yada yada, a lot of stirring stuff, and he would just go to the listening quality, just listening to these words and emotions that are running through him as he was attending to his daily affairs, and then recognize you go not to so much to that which is listened to, the word or the idea or even the emotion that it stirs, but just to the fact of that which receives these thoughts, impressions and emotions. And you go to that, oh yeah, that quality of listening, which is receptive, right? It's just receptive. Keep turning to receptive. And you can feel the sense of something annoying or disappointing or turbulent or problematic. But you get off that and you pull back from that to the very fact of receiving it. And that presence on the receptive sense, it's something you can, if you're focusing on the auditory sense, you get the sound like a kind of subtle sound, which is not a sound associated with the external stimulation, but an inner sound. And you would use that, because with that, you separate your attention from the object, which could be extremely emotionally charged. So you get off that emotional charge into something quite spacious, not by aversion to it, just by lifting your attention back. So that's quite a skill. And that quality of this kind of subtle sound is a spacious, open sense to it, feeling. Diminishes. So that's an object you can use, you know, to lessen the impact of objects, and to particularly the emotional stirrings of them. The drawback, if there is a drawback, can be that one sometimes, because of that, you lose some of the actual detailed inquiry into the object, you know, or into how you feel about these thoughts. So you, in a way, you bypass a certain amount of relational activity, which, you know, everything is its pluses and minuses, doesn't it? But that's an object, you can use that. Walking, if you're getting dull and sleepy, sometimes walking, just that movement of the body, if you get a bit rigid, your attention's got cramped, be something fluid and flowing. Obviously, loving kindness, or just cultivating a quality of whatever arises, may I resist or relinquish aversion, criticism and complaint towards it, negativity. So this is where there's metta, karuna, kindness, compassion. These are all, you could say, meditation objects. They're manifest things that we can definitely gives us a good way of establishing presence, so we can be present with that which arises. Mm. Without, and we need some support with that. Mm. And the Buddha said, well, you know, if you're doing one thing and you find yourself, you're really not establishing, you're not getting it, you're not being able to maintain your ground, you keep getting swept up, overwhelmed, flooded, then shift to another theme. Body sweeping, moving attention up and down your body, yeah, and so forth, and to find a suitable theme. Mm. So you can shift the theme. Mm. So what's the difference between doing that and just getting restless? You know, because it's, can naturally we also have a certain fidgety, restless energy. Well, essentially, what you're doing is finding a way in which you can settle into presence. And restlessness, you may follow it for a while, but it will never find a place to settle. That's its nature. So you move only in a way that you get a kind of gut feeling or a heart feeling. Actually, I'm not finding my anchorage here. I need to just shift to something more suitable, shift my vehicle. But I want to maintain presence on that vehicle, rather than just be going. Restlessness will need some kind of activity to keep it going, some kind of stimulation. So your movement is towards that which will enable me to maintain a settled state without further volitional, intentional input. Mm. Yeah. And so this requires wisdom. And naturally, with any of these things, the way you learn is by trial and error. In fact, if you get to, I've got to stay with this no matter what, you know, that's yeah, it's got some value in it. We have resolution, but it's not necessarily that wise. But at the same time, just trying to find something that's going to fit me immediately, that's not very wise either. We're going to have to do some work that's going to bring forth resolution, clarity, understanding, and so forth. So then you have a range, you can move around and stay with something, give it a workout, see if you can get into this fundamental property of the meditative domain, whether we're walking, standing, chewing, running around, or whatever doing, you know, whatever we're doing, there's a sense of, I'm present with this. And then there's going to be some wisdom arises and some deepening arises. We're deepening into our lives. This is whole themes of meditation, to deepen into, to cultivate. Because from this cultivation, then fundamental residues of greed, passion, confusion will begin to become unraveled. If you don't go to the depth, they don't. Because these are deep structures, our craving to become something, to have something, to get hold of something, is a very deep establishment. So we need to deepen in order to get into that. And the way you deepen is by maintaining steady presence. And then the deepening happens by itself. Person says they are confused by the word chitta. At first I thought it was the actual biological heart, because I think she probably heard me talking about heart as chitta. At first I thought it was the actual biological heart, so I meditated and reflected with all the attention to my heart organ, the physical organ. But today I was listening to one of his teachings and understood chitta to be part of the mind. The confusion and shock I feel is great. So the person's asking for resolution of this confusion and shock. Well, I don't quite know what's shocking about that for you particularly. But here we're looking at several things. First of all, is language, which is a slippery creature. And the fact that the Pali language doesn't exactly meet the English language. They have different, what are words? there are ways in which people try to throw some symbolic, you know, language around something that's directly experienced. And depending on how you throw these symbols and concepts around, you come up with different words: mind, heart, consciousness, awareness, you know. Right, they're all kind of, they're all sort of synonymous in some ways, aren't they? Soul, you know, spirit, all these terms we can use in English language. But then clearly, when the translators try to get some, they see this word citta. Okay, what's this mean? What's the English word? And they, by and large, they've taken the word mind. But as I've said before, the word mind is also used to translate another Pali term, manas. And we see manas is associated with mind consciousness, that which generates and deals with abstractions. Day of the week, what's going to happen tomorrow, my name. What's 5 and 10 mean? What's this? This deals with abstractions and concepts. Manas produces these. Citta is that which is both defiled and capable of being cleaned of defilements. It's both obsessive and liberated. It's grasping and released. It's compassionate and fearful. It's got hate in it and it's got beauty in it. Yeah. So I feel myself that probably heart, as a simple, easy access word, is probably a bit better than mind. Yeah. Now, where this gets kind of, interesting, we use a word like heart and say refer to the biological heart. Well, actually, it sort of does. You know, if we say, where's your mind? Most people go, oh, mind's up here. You know, it's in my mind. And I remember there's this, they did a survey, I think, had a group of Tibetan monks, and they were doing, put these brainwave detectors on their heads to detect what the alpha rhythms or the beta rhythms in their brains. You see, so they're putting these things on, because the idea was meditation definitely affects your brain waves. So you stick these kind of things on. And so these monks are sitting there, they don't quite know what's going on. And they say, we want to, okay, we're going to measure your compassion. And the monks just started laughing. It was so funny. Well, you stick it, we put it here. If you want to measure my compassion, you put it here. Don't stick it in my head. I mean, it does affect the brain waves, but that isn't where it's coming from. Because their assumption was this is where it is. The main thing, you know, is here. Right? And it does affect your brain, but it affects lots of things too. It affects your blood pressure. Yeah, it affects your hormones, neurological hormones. Yeah. So if somebody's depressed, and what do you think their bodies are like? They're just kind of flat, sunken. They're not, hey, I'm depressed, are they? They're just kind of sunk. Yeah. Somebody used to say you die of a broken heart. That's a metaphor, yeah, but well, they've now begun to recognize that the various kind of chemicals or neurological effects of deep, unremitting distress actually affect the physical heart. It contracts. I'm not a cardiologist, but it contracts, aspects of the heart begin to contract. Yeah. And as we know, you know, you visit somebody who's sick and you sit there and talk with them and they brighten up and they say it's good for your health. We have one of the monks, not in this monastery, but another place, has Alzheimer's, so you know, clearly the person can't barely communicate at all and so forth. You've got to keep things, so you have to do very simple gestures. And they say, well, we take him out for a walk. We manage to encourage him. Let's go out for a little wander. Just go for a walk and we go walk together. We walk around and just the fact of walking, his whole demeanour brightens up, and he becomes actually, he can say a few things, he can actually say things, and his tenor of his presence is increases just by the act of walking in an environment. So can you actually separate this intelligence, this sensitivity from your body? No. Can you separate from what's around you? No. You know, can you separate, and particularly with the presence of other people? Can you? You can't separate. It's affected by all these, by the environment you're in, by the energies you're in, if it's a speedy environment or sterile environment or gloomy or dark. Yeah. So what is this? What is this? I say it's citta. Yeah. So this is a little more than just processing symbols and concepts, isn't it? Which can be quite internalized. As you know, you can get very internalized in thinking a lot about what you can be doing, and completely oblivious to the world around you or to other people. And we can get so lost in our ideas of how things should be, we don't actually open up to the wonder of what actually is. Which, in some ways, I can never really understand. Why is wood like that? How did it get? Why is it, you know, how did it happen? You know? So everything's marvellous. This is different from the mind as a thinking, as a concept management, to something that manages all, a whole range of effects on the subtle level, sensual effects such as space, brightness, light, emotional effects such as the presence of other people and goodwill, personal emotional effects, we feel inspired, we have devotion, that definitely lifts and it changes the heart, changes the blood pressure and the heart rate, yeah, uplifted, fearful. There's physical effects, there's somatic effects, there's emotional effects, yeah. And this is citta. And, you know, why is so central to Buddhist practice, and the capacity and the potentials in that, I mean, it covers everything. Because when you cultivate citta, you recognize you're not separate from your environment. Then it means you begin to take responsibility for it, and also, you know, to feel you belong somewhere. Well, you don't feel separate from other people as some kind of, he's like this, I'm like that, she's better, he's worse, what is she like? Just sensitive to other people as sentient beings, humans. And all the fear and anxiety and social issues begin to diminish. Yeah. And we feel a sense of fellow feeling, loss of loneliness, loss of judgment, self-judgment disappears, yeah? And when we're understanding citta as something that's in our own bodies, yeah, this is the path to samadhi. And the Buddha, when he talks about concentration, he doesn't refer to it as a mind activity, that is, a focusing attention on a particular object. He talks about it as a heart activity of bringing up gladdening, steadying impressions such as virtue, companionship, good friendship, and lingering in those till the heart becomes settled and comfortable, and then sensing how that's affecting your body. And as those effects calm and steady and open the body up, so we're clearing off the restlessness or the dullness or the fearfulness, defensiveness. Then, he says, then everything becomes gladdened and your citta becomes unified, stabilized, steadied, concentrated. And then it has huge power to it. It becomes stable, deeply stable. fears and worries no longer affect it. Yeah. And this is a liberation. It's not a complete liberation, but this is beginning of real liberation as an actual experience. And from there, you know, you can begin to scrutinize what are things about. You begin to develop deep insight. So for many of us, this process of entering citta is dealing with often reflexes such as our defensiveness or our self-judgment. You know? These aren't decisions we make. These are just habits that happen. Yeah, that happen to us. We get angry, we get upset, we get frightened, we get lonely, whatever. These are embodied reflexes, and they generate a whole atmosphere that is dispiriting and uncomfortable for our lives. And these are then, with contemplating citta as something that has an embodied reference to it, means you're almost dealing, rewiring your fundamental emotional nervous system. Not through liking or disliking, but just like putting a gentle massage on these frayed, jangly, compulsive habits so they begin to be heard, settled, sensed, and pass on. Yeah. And this is all citta, yeah. And when we look at the Satipatthana, you see the four Satipatthana establish mindfulness on body. This is going to bring presence, give you a lot more, you know, you're collecting yourself in the present, in a very, using this very simple, obvious experience of being embodied. Absolutely necessary, because again, many of us are very much centered in our brain activity. And mental, psychological and mental activity, just coming to simplicity of bodily presence and the feeling of it. And this is what takes you into the third Satipatthana. Second is feeling, third is citta. Now, you mind, heart, spirit, soul, consciousness, awareness, whatever you want to call it, you're in the territory. And this is where some of these deep established habits, and of course the deep powers of faith and mindfulness and collectedness and wisdom are all in there. The potentials for delusion and the potentials for awakening are all in that territory. So we need the support of body to hold us present. Handling the feeling sense, because these are not ideas, these are feelings. Dukkha is a feeling, suffering is a feeling. Release from suffering is a feeling. You know, so all this is taking us into this very central territory that we need to cultivate. And thank goodness that we have this. So this is your main meditation object, is purifying the heart. So I mentioned somewhere that I talked about aditana, resolution, somewhere. I talked about this as being, as one way of manifesting it, accepting and bowing to all the negative and unskillful thoughts that kept arising in my young monastic mind. And in fact, in my old monastic mind too, as well as my middle-aged monastic mind. Keep it going, yeah. Which doesn't mean I revere and adore them, it just means I'm accepting with humility and a relationship which is non-aggressive, non-judgmental, open, and okay, how can I learn from this? So I approach these unskillful states, or what I call unskillful, they're causing stress and so forth, and what does that arise from? Where does it come from? Am I open to this? Yeah. Who is this? So this involves the bowing, both gives a sense of separation and attention, which is non-reactive. Yeah. Because the tendency would be either justify it, you know, or dismiss it, or you know, or add more and more negative thoughts, but said, oh, that's that. What can this teach me? Who is this? It's more the attitude that I would encourage. Someone's asked about the relationship or differences between vijnana and sati, these two Pali words. Vijnana means sense consciousness. And this reference means that which brings in data from the sights, sounds, touches, tastes, fragrances, and thoughts. So vijnana is the channel for that, the consciousness. I am conscious of, I see a flower. That's an act of vijnana. Sati, mindfulness, means, you know, the act of seeing a flower is being, I'm holding presence with that. I'm maintaining awareness of that action of seeing a flower. Therefore, I can contemplate my interest or disinterest when I experience that, seeing the flower. I feel happy, or I want to pick it, or I, whatever. So sati establishes presence, vijnana establishes the data that you're present with. Make sense? Yeah. Sati mindfulness gives you this is what's happening. And then the details of what's happening is brought in through vijnana consciousness. That which is affected is called citta. And what responds is also citta. Citta is the affect response system. It's affected by the sight of the flower and it responds. But the flower itself is a piece of sense data from consciousness. And mindfulness can hold that. So we recognize, how is the citta being affected by that sight of the flower? So this is how understanding and insight arises. There's one last question. It's of a different context. It's about scattering ashes after death. Person wants to know, is it okay to throw it in the scatter his ashes into the sea or a garden, keep it in an urn or a temple? Is this about attaching to a body? I don't think so. Generally the body you attach to is either the sense of being in one, which is, are you in a body? No, bodies arises, sensations and energies arise within your awareness, within your citta. You're not actually in a body. Whereabouts in a body are you? And if you open one up, there's nobody in there. But the experience of body happens to you, right? Feelings, sensations, attitudes about a body, descriptions of it, they all... and then you get very... The citta does get stuck on that. We feel sad if the body declines, or we feel excited if the body looks attractive, But it's nobody's in one. So the attachment is really just to a fantasy of some kind or a description. When a body finishes its lifespan, then you can... dispose of that in a respectful way. Often in Buddhist context, it's often through burning, because it's clean, and doesn't take up much space. And then you can keep the ashes, because then the ashes represent the person who you associated with that body. This is my mother, this is my cousin, my sister, my husband. And so then I can put them somewhere where I feel my quality of respect or love or gratitude is kind of carried by the presence of those ashes. What you do with them doesn't really matter. Where so much as the attitude of respect. You can give them back to nature, which is one way of looking at it. Like, this came from nature, I spread it back into nature. The other elements, these are just elements, came from nature, I bring them back to nature. That's a beautiful gesture. The earth or the sea. Or you can put them in an urn. This is almost like they're in my heart. My heart is the urn that's carrying my husband or my parents. So then you get something you can put on an altar and reflect upon. So it depends how the particular place depends on the gesture you want to make. But the gesture is always one of acknowledging both that these body was elements only, earth element, nobody actually lived in it. But also that somebody passed through or was embodied, was in contact in this body context for a while, and that amazing miracle that we got born has finished. I retain the memory of that person. Their gift to me is symbolized by that urn that I carry in my heart. And these would be good ways to commemorate someone who's deceased. You know, I think the idea is you're not just treating it as something rather terrible. Death is something terrible, but something that's the most natural thing in the world. So why don't we make it something that's got a positive flavour to it, rather than just grief and despair. So respect and gratitude is much more positive. And whatever you do with ashes that conveys that is the appropriate thing to do. Okay, so take my leave today. Thank you for your questions, and hope some of it's been useful.